This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On The Nolan Show today, with me, Mark Simpson, we take a deep dive into that last big TV election debate, which took place in the studio here in Belfast, just below where I'm sitting. On the programme, you will hear universal praise for one person who was there at the debate, the presenter, my BBC colleague, Tara Mills. But what about the five politicians? How did they get on? Well, we hear from five political experts. Enjoy the show.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. It's the end of the week. It's the end of the month. It's the end of the school year. But in some ways, this election campaign is only just starting to heat up. That crucial final TV debate was last night. So did it? Did it change your mind in any way about how you're going to vote next Thursday? Let's listen again to some of the big moments.
Well, first of all, we don't sit on the fence. We have a strong position.
You're entitled to your view. People vote for you on that basis.
Well, no, I don't accept that at all, and I think it's actually inappropriate of you to put it that way.
The Irish Sea border still exists.
This isn't easy. Again, we're dealing with Tory austerity. It's not easy.
We want Northern Ireland to work. You're saying that. We aren't seeing it.
All parties in the British government acknowledge this place has been historically underfunded. So what's the point in being a part of the UK?
We're not calling for a border poll right now. What we're saying is it's going to come a lot sooner than people think, so we have to get ready. That's why I set up a New Ireland Commission. We're having thousands of conversations and working on policy. This, for me, is a very attractive proposition. We talked about Joel talked about the financial situation here. This place is an economic basket, kids. Let's be honest.
With all the problems that our NHS has, with the cost implications of the health service south of the border, for example, the costs for individuals on prescriptions and doctor's appointments and GP appointments.
At least they can get GP appointments.
We don't pay for those here because we have the National Health Service. We're very good at talking sometimes things down.
We do, for once, have an executive facing in the right direction. We have actually the opposition agreeing with us with regard to the financing of Northern Ireland and being funded under the point of need. That argument has been won.
I think the comments, the very significant comments from the former Taoiseach Leo Varadkar last week in Belfast are hugely telling when he said it is time now for the Irish government to ensure that reunification is a political objective of the Irish government and not just an aspiration.
Well, we'll see how that goes.
I'm
just going to take some more questions or some more points from Leo.
Our Stormont as it stands today is no more stable than it was a day before it collapsed the last time. Now, nobody should be living with that hanging over their heads when we're dealing with serious issues like health, education, policing and justice and all of those other challenges.
Fascinating stuff, I thought so anyway. Well done to Tara Mills, by the way, who handled the debate expertly. The politicians were, of course, Naomi Long from Alliance, Colm Eastwood from the SDLP, Robbie Butler from the Ulster Unionist Party, Chris Hazard from Sinn Féin, and Gavin Robinson from the DUP. The music, you know the music, Funboy 3 and Bananarama. Long before your time, political correspondent Jim McCormick, but you were watching last night. What was your verdict?
Definitely more energy last night, Mark, it has to be said, but you would be expecting that given that we are 1 week, or we were at that point 1 week exactly away from the polls closing. There was always going to be, though, because there's more jeopardy when you have a live audience. I think it's difficult to squeeze four big topics into discussion in less than under an hour. You've got the five politicians to get around. Did we learn anything new? I don't think so. It's largely the same ground that's been covered over the past 5 weeks. There were lots of side swipes from each politician behind their podium. There weren't any knockout blows. I don't think anybody expected that there would be. I think they'll all be pleased that nobody dropped the ball at this late stage, because that can be crucial at a point like this in the campaign. I think the focus now, they can breathe a sigh of relief. They can look forward to next Thursday. And of course, by this time next week, all of the counting, hopefully, all of it should be done. We will know who the 18 winners are going to be, those MPs who will be heading to Westminster. And crucially, we'll also know who any potential losers will be.
And in a sentence, I'm going to let you go. I know you've got a busy day ahead. Is that it? No more big debates?
That's it. I would expect that any debating we will see from now until next Thursday will just be over the likes of social media. We know that the parties have all been playing a pretty good game when it comes to getting their message out across different platforms. We've seen some of them on TikTok over the course of this campaign. Our social media reporter Claire Graham has been doing a good job at pointing some of the key issues out there. I think they'll all just try and keep going. You know, they talk about an election being a marathon, not a sprint. Well, we're in the final stages of that marathon. And I think all of the parties recognise it's important that none of them slow down now.
Jean, thank you. Have a good day. The Belfast Telegraph, Sam McBride, is on the line, as is the political commentator and former Sinn Féin election candidate, Chris Donnelly. Chris, I want to come to you first, because you were saying nice things about the BBC last night on social media. The format was good.
Are you, first of all, good morning, Mark. Are you saying I don't say good things about the BBC often? But listen, no, I think you're right. I think two things you're right about. Format was very good. Tara Mills was excellent, and I think that helped really in terms of the flow of it and challenging the politicians one after the other. Jane's right too. It was a lively one. I enjoyed that. I thought it was a bit more animated, a bit more passion, because there is that element of jeopardy, not just because of the audience there, but also because we're getting closer. I think what was particularly interesting, you know, first issue discussed was a devolved matter, health, but it's that important that people want to discuss that here. We also got the Middle East, which again, our local politicians really aren't going to have too much to say on dictating British government policy through Westminster. But it shows you, because what it shows you is that those, regardless of what the election, whether it was the locals or assembly or Westminster, it's how people are feeling. It's what the temperature is. What are the main topical issues that people are feeling that might sway their votes? That's what people are going to want to hear their politicians talk about.
Any winners, any losers last night in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I think that firstly, and I saw a lot of it on social media, Colm Eastwood is the most natural debater that we have, and he was on the front foot throughout. But then again, he has to be. He is the one, more than any of the other five there, who's having to do the chasing at the moment. He has to try and stand out. He has to make the noise to be noticed. Now, he's very good at it. The difficulty for the SDLP is he's always been a good debater. It hasn't always translated into votes. And certainly the last two elections, the assembly election, the local election, that hasn't manifested itself. But really, he's fighting for his own political survival here. He needs to come back with his seat, and Claire Hannah's at the least, and show some movement, I think, in those heartlands, those former SDLP heartlands like Snurley and Armagh and South Down. My only fear for Colm Eastwood's party is this election has come too soon in the devolved era. You know, he needs, where he was going to be sharpest is if we've had another 6 months to another year of devolved government, he's leading the opposition. If people out there are starting to get a bit antsy about what's happening at Stormont, then he'll have a more receptive audience. It just might be too soon for him now.
It's worth saying we
don't want to go into constituency matters. I think you touched on a couple there, Chris. A full list of candidates is on the BBC News NI website. 136, I think, in total. Sam McBride, your verdict.
Good morning, Mark. Strange as it might seem, I'm going to say something nice about the BBC as well. There are things which the BBC do not do very well, but this is a bit like Test Match Special or covering a World Cup or something of that nature. This is done brilliantly every time, frankly. I think it was Jim Fitzpatrick the last time. He was great. Last night it was Tara Mills. She was excellent at it. You've got a live audience there. That might not seem like a big thing, but you saw with UTV, I think, how you miss that. It seems a little bit more real when there's real people reacting to it. There weren't the ad breaks you had. It was going out live rather than being pre-recorded. I mean, just those are small little things that most people won't necessarily think about, but they make a big difference. They cost money. That's why it doesn't happen elsewhere sometimes. But it really, I think, is quite important when it's the only proper debate that you have in this campaign. The one big problem last night was that there were two leaders missing. Now, that's not the BBC's fault. They invited them. There was not Michelle O'Neill. There was not Doug Beattie. But not having two leaders is obviously going to undermine having something which is meant to be a leaders' debate.
And winners and losers?
Well, I think almost everybody who looked at last night fairly, I think, can see that Colm Eastwood was just completely beyond anyone else there. He was really quite sensational. He's very good at this, as Chris says. It doesn't necessarily translate into any votes whatsoever. So I'm not suggesting that that's necessarily going to be massively big for him personally, but or for his party. But when you look at what happened last night, he was brilliant when he was speaking on his own. He was brilliant at coming in with little one-liners. And it's a very particular skill to be able to intervene sharply against your opponents without coming across as somebody who's really quite boorish and is trying to dominate things. He was able to do that with a bit of a smile, with a bit of humour, but really get his point across very well.
The point that you make, Sam, let's delve into it a little bit more about why two leaders, certainly within Northern Ireland or within Stormont, weren't there, Doug Beattie and Michelle O'Neill. Let's start with Sinn Féin. Chris Hazard from Sinn Féin was asked about why Michelle O'Neill was not there instead of him.
Just wouldn't mind an answer to that question about where is Michelle O'Neill this evening.
Michelle O'Neill will be out in the canvas, I have no doubt, like every other Sinn Féin representative. We're busy on the canvas trail. I am the Westminster Group lead for the party. I'm delighted to be here. Like everybody else in this platform, I am a candidate next Thursday in the South Town constituency.
Well, we're not going to get into the... Yeah,
well,
There's a full list of candidates on the website.
Well said, Tara. What about Doug Beattie? Why was he not there? Here's Robbie Butler.
Where's Doug Beattie tonight?
Doug Beattie had other arrangements in his diary. I'm the deputy leader, so the leadership is on the stage and with that policy input.
Chris Donnelly, maybe, just maybe, was it a mistake by both parties not to have their biggest hitters there?
I don't think so. I think yes, possibly for the Ulster Unionists, no for Sinn Féin. And for this reason, they've done this before and the electorate hasn't been annoyed in the slightest. And of course, Sinn Féin, and Chris Hazard didn't say it, but obviously if they're going to have their leader, that would be normally the time that a Sinn Féin politician would point out that they're an all-Ireland political party and the leader would be Mary Lou McDonald. But I think the issue for Sinn Féin is they're playing this one conservatively. They're trying to hold the base and keep what they have, all the constituent parts of the voter coalition that they've managed to successfully assemble over the last few elections. So what does that look like? Well, you'll notice at each of these discussions so far, John Finucane at one of the debates, now Chris Hazard, they're almost reluctant participants. They're sitting back, they're making contributions, but they're not really going toe-to-toe with anybody. They're letting the other stuff happen, which is what Michelle O'Neill was doing yesterday, opening a women's centre on the Shankill Road, then walking in behind a Lambeg drum to open the Lisburn Fela in the centre of Lisburn. You know, it's that message. They know Michelle O'Neill has become quite a good electoral asset. So she had a good performance with Mark Carruthers, and that's not easy, the other night. And so now they're going to, as far as I can see, it was a smart move from their perspective. Let her sit that one out. It maintains this vision of a perception of positivity because they're just trying to hold what they've already got over the last two elections. For the Ulster Unionists, I think it's more perplexing because Doug Beattie's a leader. Look, Doug Beattie's the one under pressure. Doug Beattie, I think, should have been the one front and centre. Robbie Butler, again, for the second kind of successive date, debate. He just wasn't at it, you know, in that total confrontation with the others. I think Doug Beattie might have been better in that regard.
Robbie Butler might say that he was just being a bit more courteous than the others.
Yeah, that's not necessarily the best approach in debates.
That's politics. That's politics. Sam, what do you think about those two leaders not being there?
I think that it was a problem for both those parties. It's not a coincidence, I think, that the two people who my colleague Suzanne Breen thinks were at the bottom of the pile last night were Robbie Butler and Chris Hazard. I think they struggled. I think that Chris Hazard particularly, who is quite good in debate, I mean, he's sharp on his feet. He's not the worst person you could send to something like that. But it was pretty unforgivable, I think, in terms of being well prepared, that he had no real answer to that question of where is Michelle O'Neill. It was such an obvious question. What you didn't hear in that little clip was that actually when he was asked it the first time, he completely ignored the question, which doesn't look good, I think, to reasonable people watching this. And if Michelle O'Neill is a big electoral asset, why not send her out? I think Chris is right. She did well against Mark Carruthers. I think she probably did better against Mark Carruthers than anybody else in those very difficult interviews. So why not build on that? Why have this sense she's being hidden away, that yes, she's doing photo ops, she's doing little video clips for social media. That's not scrutiny. That's not what we ought to have in a real full-blooded contest for our votes. It might make sense in some ways from Sinn Féin's point of view to play this cannily, but I think from their perspective, and the same applies to the Ulster Unionists, if you're not going to send Doug Beattie, send somebody like Tim Collins, send somebody who might really shake it up. There are skills that Robbie Butler has, but he's not the best person they have at entering into that full-blooded debate. And that's something that is a problem for a party that's trying to have its voice heard, that's trying to make sure it's not bypassed there. So, yes, from their perspective, from our perspective as an audience, I think it was a problem last night.
But does it really matter? Do these debates matter one iota? Let's talk to Alison Morris as well from the Belfast Telegraph. And why not bring in a professor? It's a time for a political scientist, Professor John Tong from the University of Liverpool. What does the science tell us about the import of nights like last night? Good morning, John.
Good morning. Well, I'm sure that the viewing figures will have been a lot higher for last night compared to Sunday when UTV were up against the Scotland game anyway, and the viewing figures were very poor by all accounts. So last night will have made more impact. I agree with all that Chris and Sam said about the value of an audience being there, and I'd echo everything that was said about Tara Mills doing a very good job hosting it. In terms of what impact it makes, probably not that much. I mean, the people who watched it last night were more likely to be interested in politics, if you look at surveys of people who watch these debates. And secondly, they're more likely to have already decided their political choice come next Thursday anyway. So there won't be that many voters whose minds will be changed. But then again, in several of the constituencies in Northern Ireland, not getting into anyone in particular, but in several constituencies, you don't need that many voters to change their mind to potentially significantly affect the outcome. So in that sense, last night really did matter. I thought there were some odd bits to the debate, I have to say. I didn't understand really why Chris Hazard and Colm Eastwood ended up arguing about who goes to Westminster more at one point, which seems strange given Sinn Féin is an abstentionist party. I didn't really get that. I mean, given that the whole focus of this election more broadly right across the UK has been about issues of trust, you know, it might have been more interesting if Chris Hazard had sort of gone a bit more traditional Republican and said, well, this oath of allegiance that you swear, Colm, do you really believe it? And it could have discomfited him in that way. I'd have been interested to see Colm's response to that. I agree overall Colm won the debate insofar as there is such a thing as winning the debate. And then we had the slightly odd spat as well between Gavin Robinson and Robbie Butler over Robbie Butler's CV and his application for the post of Children's Commissioner, which again, I thought, where is this actually going? So I thought there were some oddities in the debate, but it was much more interesting, I thought, than the previous one.
Alison, what do you make of it? Does it matter?
I don't think at this stage that it's going to change anyone's mind. You'll notice that the majority of the back and forth was between Naomi Long and Gavin Robinson, because they are basically in the market for the same voters. They are shopping in the same supermarkets. They need the same people to vote for them and for one of them to win that seat. In regards to everyone else, I think especially in the general election, there's a lot of party loyalty and voter loyalty. You're not going to change anyone's mind in terms of trying to maybe win votes over. But what they could do is they could lose votes if any of them had dropped a major clanger. And that's always the real chance that parties are taking when they participate in these type of leaders' debates. And that's why I thought it was interesting Sam said, why did the UUP not send someone like Tim Collins? Well, for the people watching and for ourselves sitting last night watching that debate, that might have been wildly entertaining, but it would have been a high risk strategy for Doug Beattie. Robbie Butler is just a nice guy. That's it. He's probably too nice for politics, if the truth be told. And he's too nice to interrupt people when he maybe should have been and been more assertive. And I can see the value in sending people who are standing in election, like Chris Hazard, that last minute raise a profile just before people go to the polls. But I do agree that Michelle O'Neill would have been an asset to that debate last night. She did very well. Mark Cruthers really holds people's feet to the fire. We know that. He's one of the best at what he does, and she did manage to hold her own in that interview, and I think sort of proved herself against those people who would say, you know, that she can only do those very staged Sinn Féin managed videos that they do with their own social media managers. She did do well, and I think she would have held her own last night. But again, I think at this stage, especially you can see with the Robbie Butler and Chris Hazard situation, it's parties trying to get their candidates out there, get them on primetime TV, get as much coverage as possible right before people go to the polls next week.
You brought up Gavin Robinson and Naomi Long. Let's hear a little more from each of them. First of all, Gavin Robinson, as we know, one of the questions was about trust in politics. And Tara Mills put it to the DUP leader.
Gavin Robinson, making Northern Ireland work. It's a bit rich, given that you were down, you suspended the government for 2 years.
Well, no, I don't accept that at all. And I think it's actually inappropriate of you to put it that way. We would far rather not have had government come down at all. We would far rather have had a situation where people would recognise that this place works properly and positively on the basis of consensus. And whenever unionism, collectively, in its entirety, was indicating that the Northern Ireland Protocol was fundamentally an imposition on the constitutional position of Northern Ireland and was not going to wash, that should have caused the body politic to sit back and say, actually, we have a problem here.
The Alliance leader Naomi Long was challenged over not attending an Ireland's Future event in Belfast earlier this month.
When it comes to a border poll, we want to be part of conversations around constitutional change. We are open to those conversations, but what we are not going to do is vote along ideologically driven lines. We are about trying to look at the practicalities of what a United Ireland might look like, of what a reformed United Kingdom might look like in terms of, for example, our fiscal arrangements. We want to be part of those conversations because whatever the outcome, and it won't be decided by any of us here, it will be decided by the people
in this
audience.
Well, it may well be decided by Alliance voters, and yet you didn't go to the Ireland's Future event and speak at that and hear and debate and decide and come to a decision guide and lead.
We were never going to be coming to a decision at the Ireland's Future event. We were there to listen.
Surely it's part of that process that you're talking about.
We were there to listen and participate and to highlight things like, why would we go and have a border poll now when there is no strong proposition? We tried that with Brexit. It was a disaster.
Please say we should.
We need to know what it is we're aiming towards, and we're happy to engage in shaping it.
So the border came up, trust came up, the health service came up, Sam McBride, Gaza came up as well. Do you think most of the important bases were covered?
That's a good question, because I'm trying to think of all of the many things that were not covered. I mean, one striking thing was that lots of what was covered was about things which are Stormont's responsibility.
Yes.
Now, as Tara Mills said, because that's what voters are raising. And these things are not entirely unrelated, because the money for the health service, for instance, comes from London. These things are not wholly unrelated to each other. But yes, was there debate about Ukraine? Was there debate about international relations, about migration, about some of the big things that Westminster will be dealing with? No, there wasn't. But I think that it was a good debate. You're only ever in these things going to scratch the surface. But I think it was done in a pretty pretty detailed way, if that's not completely absurd to say. And I think that if you look at what was being said about things like Gaza last night, yes, these were party positions mostly being wheeled out, which are pretty familiar to a lot of us now. But if you're looking at this and you don't follow politics closely, and some people will want to have some sense of who these people are, what these parties stand for before they go and do their democratic duty next week, and they don't necessarily have to follow closely everything that's gone on over the last number of years, you would have got, I think, a pretty good sense of who those people are, what those parties stand for, and that ultimately is what this is meant to be about.
Alison Morris, do many of your friends watch these debates as well, or is it just nerds and geeks like us?
Well, you see, I have two actual group of friends. So I have the nerds and geeks like yourself, who I sometimes hang around with, and then I have, you know, actual West Belfast friends who know they don't particularly watch those debates. Yeah, some of them do, and some of them are really interested in issues which are mainly, to be quite honest with you, Stormont or devolved issues. And one of the things that people keep asking me about, especially when I'm out about, it's childcare and it's public sector pay rises, and it's all of those things. It's things that aren't necessarily attached to Westminster, or that Westminster won't be able to do much about. The constitutional issue is obviously a big thing for nationalists, and we know that is the case, but that's something that people are building towards. They accept that that's something that's coming down the line. One of the things I think that can be a bit of a sore point, especially for Sinn Féin in this election, has been Gaza and has been that trip to Westminster. And I know that even from speaking to people who have been at canvassing, it's one of the things they're being asked at the doors. There's a whole range of topics which is so different than the 2019 election, because remember that was almost exclusively about Brexit. It was all we spoke about in the run-up to it. Could Brexit be stopped? Could it not be stopped? What was going to happen after that general election? So, to be honest with you, this is quite refreshing that there's a whole diverse range of topics being discussed, and it's not just an election concentrating on one issue.
Are you excited about next week, Alison?
Well, I'm actually exhausted, and we haven't even reached that point yet. So I think, you know, with some sleep, when you think about everything else that's coming down the line for us as journalists next week as well, before we even get to the election, it's going to be a very busy week. I think that the message of this is, you know, try and catch up on your sleep and then stock up on, you know, energy drinks and all sorts of other things for the very long count. But yeah, I do think that I'll be in Titanic, as will a lot of other people, watching those marginal seats and seeing how they go. The East Belfast ones should come in quite early, and that's one of the ones that I think that once we see East Belfast, you'll know the shape of the election in general. But yeah, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people are saying it's been quite a boring campaign. I think it's been so quick that for me, I don't think it's been boring. I think it's been quite interesting. And if we'd had a big long run up to an autumn election, I think we all might have got a lot more bored, I suppose, or fed up with it than we have now. Voter turnout as well, and I know people keep saying that, but that's going to be one of the stories of this election as well.
Huge, because, you know, a lot of people are going on holidays next week. The schools are out. The weather's due to improve. Alison, thank you. We'll let you and Sam go back to your day jobs at the Belfast Telegraph. I want Chris and John to hang on, because after the news, I want to talk to them about football. They're big fans. I want to talk to them about what that West Belfast priest said yesterday about praying for England to be knocked out of the Euros. It's just after 9:30. Let's get the news. It's Mark Simpson standing in this Friday morning. Big weekend of football coming up. The Euros are down to the last 16. England will be playing Slovakia at 5:00 on Sunday. Will you be supporting them? Well, yesterday the Euros were mentioned, wait for it, in a prayer request read out by a priest in West Belfast. Have a listen to this.
Dear Mother of Perpetual Help, and this is a funny last one, but very serious. Put England out of the Euros. We are still getting 1966. Please, you would never hear the end of it. A loving daughter with a sense of humour. P.S. I have been praying to P.O. as well.
Oh, that was brilliant. How seriously should we take it, though, Chris Donnelly? What did you think when you heard that?
Listen, Mark, people take their prayer petitions to Clonard very seriously. You know, personal and private troubles are often aired no respecting anonymity. And I can tell you from having been there at times, you know, it can be heart-wrenching, the burdens that people carry whilst wearing smiles every day. And the way they're composed by people themselves and they're shared for others to collectively pray for and support. So it's actually nice to have a lighter moment like that. And I have to say, of course, many of us in West Belfast have long cherished our Slovakian links at the moment, Mark. And of course, if England get through, we will, of course, go on to cherish our links and affinity with the Swiss or Italians, depending upon which team gets through to face the English.
That's interesting, the context, Chris, for people don't know the context of yesterday, but maybe people with terminal illnesses or very serious illnesses or people who had lost loved ones would have been prayed for, and this was a bit of light relief at the end?
Yes, I think you heard the priest there. He actually said that. He prefaced it by saying it was a bit of a lighter one, and I think that is, you know, to be serious about it, it can be heart-wrenching when you're sitting listening to those at each of the masses. Conor Novi is a magnificent thing, goes on every year. Many of my friends and within the school community, many of the children, the parents and the staff would go. So when this hurt, because this started rippling out, you know, yesterday, it was actually quite nice, because okay. In that type of context, it's nice to have some, you heard the laughter amongst the congregation too.
John Tong, do you think England fans will see the funny side?
I hope so, yeah. I think it's brilliant. It's really funny banter. I'm loving the increasing desperation that whenever England actually do quite well in a tournament, the prayers get ever longer and more desperate for England to get knocked out. I mean, this could be an example of a prayer being realised fairly quickly, though. I mean, based on the performances so far, I mean, they've not, you know, we've not exactly set the tournament alight. I mean, Southgate, in one sense, his prayers have been realised, getting this side of the draw, and you think that England ought to be able to make progress, but based on the performances so far, I mean, the team looks pretty chaotic. But I mean, people get upset that over this for no reason. I mean, I saw the leader of Plaid Cymru interviewed yesterday, and he was asked, are you supporting England in this tournament? He said, no, he basically was honest. He said, no, of course I'm not. You know, I'm Welsh. Why should I support England? Mm. And when the reporter grilled him further on it, he said, look, I'm a Cardiff fan as well. You know, we have, it's all about rivalry. Cardiff versus Swansea is a massive rivalry there. So why on earth would I support England? They're rivals in the same way. You know, I'll be honest, I wasn't, you know, cheering against Scotland when they got knocked out. I'll be honest, I did smile when they...
Oh, John.
But that's football rivalry. You know, I mean, the other set of prayers has been offered, though, by Manchester United fans when they were linked with Gareth Southgate.
Oh,
they wouldn't get him as manager.
Our prayers have been answered there.
Yeah, exactly. He's not gonna get that job. But yeah, I don't really see why people get het up about it. I mean, it's sport, it's rivalry.
We're going to go to Malachy in a moment, who was there in West Belfast yesterday. But a quick score prediction. I know you two guys have to go. First of you, all you, John, England against Slovakia Sunday night. Who's your money on?
I think England might scrape it 1-0.
Chris?
Mm. Yeah, I'd love to see Slovakia do it in penalties, but I think England will win 2-0.
You heard it here first. Thanks, John Tong. Thanks, Chris Donnelly. Malachy, you were there yesterday. Was it a shock?
Increased desperation. I've just written that down. John Tong just went up my estimation. Yes, I was there. And the circumstances are, just a bit of background.
Yes.
The novena was on for 9 days, and people put their petitions in at the altar, and it's all about people who've got cancer or suffering from alcoholism or gambling or whatever it is that you suffer from. These petitions are put in the altar and everyone prays for them. And they had Presbyterian ministers there, they had Methodist ministers there, giving sermons about just life in general and the hardship. And in the novena, they read out about two or three petitions at the end of every mass from different people to say, you know, my youngster's doing exams, pray for, or my wife or my husband's an alcoholic, pray for them. And it's really serious stuff. But they always put a small one in at the end, which has a bit of fun. Mm. And that particular priest was a Spanish guy.
Oh,
and
I was wondering, actually.
Yeah, he was from Spain.
Okay.
And he was giving the sermon. And funny enough, I met him every night myself going out in novena and actually said to him, Spain are doing fantastic in the Euros. Let's hope they come up against England. This is only me personally. And he says, yes, he says, I'm hoping they'll do well. Because he obviously, he's a young guy. he's in his 20s. And at the very end of the novena yesterday, he turned around and he read out a petition that wasn't his views.
Okay,
and he said, there's a young person here, and the petition is, please, 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 ask the mother of Papadia help to get England knocked out of the Euros, because if they win, I don't think I could live with it. And everyone burst out laughing. And that was it. The priest didn't say, let's pray for England to get put out of the Euros. That wasn't the case.
Malachy, it's important to put it into context. It's important also that you get hold of this priest, this Spanish priest, and get him on the radio for me, that I can speak to him in person on Monday. Would you do that for me?
Well, I would do that for you, Joel, no problem. Unfortunately, when the novena was over, he was that good at what he was doing, because he had the wee Spanish accent and all, which all added the ambience of the thing. They said they would try and keep him. He's a Redemptorist priest, and they were sending him back to Spain. Now, I could probably go down today or tomorrow and see if he's not going back to Monday or Tuesday.
Or get a number for him for us, Malachy. Do that. It'd be lovely to hear from him.
Okay, no problem, Jim.
Sounds like he's good crack. Malachy, thank you. Jared's on the air. Jared, you want to talk about the TV debate last night, is that right?
Yeah, indeed. Mark, good morning. You'd pose the question, I suppose, as to whether there are any winners or losers. I would say that Naomi Long came across as very moderate. She always does in any of those interviews that I've ever watched of her. I mean, our problem over here, as most everybody knows ad nauseum, is that we have too many dinosaurs with Sinn Féin that just bang on about United Ireland. We have the UP and Jim Allister and stuff going on about the border and the sea border. I mean, people need to get to a stage, live and let live. I can't defend myself as a nationalist because I was raised a Catholic. I don't practice anymore, so I'm not a nationalist. I don't want a united Ireland.
They would deny being dinosaurs, Jared. Did you have a winner last night?
Yeah, Naomi Long.
Okay, gotcha. Graham in Portadown, who was your winner?
No, there's no winners, to be honest. It has confirmed my conviction that I should no longer participate in this delusion and insanity of actually voting. Not for another mandatory coalition with the same people who will promise you absolutely everything and aspirational rubbish. But when they get in, they do absolutely nothing. And they've done nothing for 25 years, and they'll do nothing for the next 25 years. So I'm going to save my time and take the dog for a walk or something a bit more practical, I think.
Graham, one vote could swing a seat. It has happened before.
Maybe, but as long as we have a mandatory coalition with the same people arguing about the same things, and they want to micromanage absolutely everything and couldn't agree on what they have for lunch. So I'm definitely not participating in it. And anybody who does it, to be honest, is delusional and slightly insane, I think.
This is a Westminster election. I'm going to try one more time to persuade you to vote. I think there's almost an argument that says you can't complain if you don't actually participate. I mean, this is a Westminster election, so you're not voting for a mandatory coalition. You're voting for your MP.
Well, that is true. But what has my MP done in the last 25 years for me? Or what has any of the actual MPs ever done for me? They'll promise you everything, and it's as usual. They'll promise you everything until you get your vote, and then when you go to look for one, I mean, I looked for one about 8 weeks ago or 9 weeks ago over two issues. I'm still waiting on a response. So my response is to the person I went to, well, I'm no longer voting, and I'm no longer voting for you. So. That's my opinion.
Graham, that is your right, and we hear it on the airwaves. People who have totally the opposite experience, including in your area, that their MP, their councillor, their MLA is there when they need them. The first question last night was perhaps the most important question of the night, posed by Kelly from the audience, posed about the health service. We're going to bring you a story, a disturbing story on the face of it, from Cumber, about an 83-year-old man with a broken leg who says he was waiting for up to 8 hours for an ambulance. But before we hear from his family, let's get a flavour of the health debate last night and the whole issue around the health budget. Here's the SDLP leader, Colm Eastwood.
This what are has you doing about that collapsed. Then at Westminster well, what, the, as an MP? What are you
well,
doing?
Let me just explain. Even though we're in opposition, these guys are all in government, we are happy to work with everybody else because this is far too important. But where are these decisions taken? They're taken at Westminster. We need to go with one single voice and ask the British government to properly fund this health service because it absolutely has collapsed. We need a Marshall Plan. We need real leadership, real resource, and then we need to take some tough decisions to actually get this done.
You've been there and you haven't been able to get that money.
That's because we've just spent the first 5 minutes squabbling about numbers. We have to be together on this, and I think we can make a strong case to a new British government, because otherwise this thing is going to fall completely.
Well, the health portfolio is held currently by the Ulster Unionist Party. Their deputy leader, Robbie Butler, was asked about this on the debate last night. He was asked about his party walking away from the health budget.
Yes, but Anna, you is, are but, holding so, the health so it's, portfolio. It's the Ulster Unionist
If you would let me make my point,
Robin
please, guys.
Promised it within 2 weeks and we're
the
still
The Ulster Unionist Party have taken health twice. We took it under Michael McGimsey as well. Sinn Féin and the DUP, in their manifestos previously, had promised £1 billion extra funding to health. And what we did see was a 2.3% reduction. Our plan is to have ministerial leadership. It is to work with our executive partners to agree a budget.
Well, just up the road from Stormont is the town of Cumber. There was an incident there recently. Chris contacted the Nolan Show yesterday about it. His 83-year-old father-in-law had collapsed, and the family were desperately in need of an ambulance, but it didn't arrive immediately. Did it, Chris? Good morning to you.
Morning. How are you?
I'm good, Chris, but it sounds as if your father-in-law was and still is in pretty bad shape.
He is indeed, yes. He's in hospital with multiple fractures to the femur. On his leg. It wasn't 8 hours. It was basically there's been two incidents involving our family. Basically, my aunt fell in a shopping centre on the May 9th and lay inside the shopping centre for over 4 hours, and no ambulance actually came. Basically, the fire brigade had to come and actually lift her and put her onto a trolley and wheel her out to a waiting car, which then took her down to the hospital, which then she had to sit in her for 6 hours by no painkillers but a broken leg. And it was only after my brother actually walked into the see a doctor, and the doctor turned and seen her leg, that he turned and said she needs to go straight in for x-ray. But then on Sunday night, my father-in-law, he fell and basically fractured his femur in multiple places. We rang the ambulance service and we were told on the phone there is no ambulance available or a paramedic car to come out to him.
So what happened next? And,
well, we had the basically sit there with him and try and keep him comfortable and reassure him. And basically, we had to keep trying. We rang back numerous times to try and get them to see what's taking so long. And basically, all you kept getting was that there's no ambulances available.
So how long did it take for one to eventually arrive, Chris?
It arrived about an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes after he had fell.
Right.
So we had And basically, I mean.
So let's make that clear. Our initial information was wrong there. We said at the top of the programme, 8 hours. It was only, tell us, let's get the facts right. And apologies for that if we have misled our listeners. How long was it?
It was an hour, between an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes for my father in law. And it was over, no ambulance actually came for me. She was laying a store for over 4 hours.
Okay.
Waiting on an ambulance which never ever came.
Okay. But, you know, I take it it wasn't life-threatening for your father-in-law. You know, if the ambulance service are busy under 2 hours, you might expect that in this day and age, no?
We shouldn't. Not with an 83-year-old mom with, no, I mean, we knew straight away that he had either smashed his hip or done his femur. Then these are two major, and they're two major injuries for elderly people. People can't bleed out into that leg. No, I mean, so it should have been. It should be quick. You shouldn't. No, I mean, you shouldn't have to wait an hour and a half, 2 hours. Then it's stressful enough for a family to watch their loved one laying on the ground, unable to do anything. Now, what happens if that person takes an hour turn? The only thing I was told to do is run down the street and grab a defibrillator and bring it back to the house.
But Chris, you know what a triage situation is like. Sadly, there were maybe other patients, believe it or not, in even more desperate need than your father-in-law at the time.
Yeah, but as I say, no, I mean, the likes of my aunt on who fell store in the 9th of May, we were told there was only one ambulance covering the whole of the South Eastern Health Board area. And that was sitting at that major accident that happened on the day two. And that's the reason why no ambulance was able to come. Surely, you know, I mean, if they haven't got, they need to have more than just one ambulance covering the southeastern area.
What, we don't know that for sure, and I need to be very careful here, particularly because we got cross wires. We thought we had been told it was an 8-hour wait. Just to reiterate, it wasn't. It was under 2 hours, and you are saying that even at the time, and I'm not undermining what you went through, you know, when it's you and it's your loved one, you're desperate for help. I'm not undermining that at all. But now in the cold light of day, thankfully your father-in-law, it's Hugh, isn't it, Hugh? Hugh, you know, he has survived. He got to hospital. I'm sure the care he's getting at the moment round the clock is good. Do you not understand in context that sadly these things happen?
But shouldn't be happening. People have paid war. People have their taxes all their lives, and when they're needing their hour of need, someone should be there for them. No, I mean, families are already enough stress and pressure trying to deal with the situation on the ground without having any help coming. Breaking a femur, the severe pain he had to lie there in. People are being left in severe pain for quite a few hours because nobody can come to them.
How's he doing? You know what I mean? How's he doing, Chris?
He's due to get major surgery today.
Oh, bless him. At 83?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
It just there's something needs to be done, you know what I mean? Because how many people are actually not getting help in time and actually dying because of ambulances not getting there?
Gotcha. And I take it's the system that you think needs more resources, more money ultimately, yeah?
Well, it does, yeah. Because at the end of the day, you know what I mean? I complained then with the Northern Ireland Ambulance Services back in after my aunt fell. And the last correspondence I've heard from him was the 7th of June. I haven't had one more word since that neither. Policy is that they're meant to come back to you in 20 days.
Gotcha. We're going to follow up on all of this, and just to reiterate, it was less than 2 hours that your father-in-law had to wait, but it was an agonising wait. Hugh, if you're listening, wish you well with the surgery today. Thank you to Chris, and best wishes to you and all of your family. The time is, 8:10. Big, big weekend coming up in Dublin. The All-Ireland GAA quarter-final, some people jetting in for that. Of course, 3 nights of Taylor Swift. It's the start of the holiday season. As we know, the schools get off north and south at the end of this week. There really couldn't be a worse time for this dispute within Aer Lingus. Let's get the very latest from our travel expert, Simon Calder. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Mark. And I'm afraid, yes, it is looking pretty dire in terms of people wanting to travel. So over the course of the first week of the work to rule, which actually began on Wednesday and is continuing indefinitely, and also the strike taking place tomorrow, 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. by pilots working for Aer Lingus belonging to the Irish Airline Pilots Association, we have already 270 cancellations, an extraordinary number of flights, most of them going to GB, continental Europe. Every day there's a New York flight that's taken out of the schedules. So it's looking pretty messy. And there were talks yesterday at the Labour Court in Dublin. Those broke up without any agreement. The two sides seem a very long way apart. And unfortunately, things have now started getting really, really serious. And I'm reminded, if you go back 15 years, do you remember the British Airways dispute? Well, that was a very long running and bitter dispute. And this one appears to be going the same way, in that Aer Lingus is now withdrawing staff travel privileges. And the union is very, very angry. Pilots voted 99% in favour of industrial action, and well, stuck in the middle, the poor old passenger.
My goodness, Sam, where are you? It sounds as if you're in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, well, no, I caught the train. I'm in beautiful Burgundy in France, so I'm enjoying the countryside. But unfortunately, if I might also say, Mark, from British GB airports, we've seen huge numbers of cancellations over the past 48 hours, mostly due to stormy weather across large parts of Europe. And so there's going to be an awful lot of people trying to get to various places. We had, for instance, a dozen flights on EasyJet alone cancelled in and out of Liverpool John Lennon Airport. There's loads of people stranded all over the place. And this is a time you want absolutely every single resource. And if you're grounding, well, as Aer Lingus is today, 26 flights representing about 4,000 passengers, that's going to make things even worse. So, yeah, you couldn't expect a worse start to the summer for particularly Northern Ireland families who would be heading to Dublin in order to fly out passenger duty.
And you've been looking at the very latest. There's no end in sight. Both sides seem to be digging in.
That they are, except that the fact that these talks took place at all yesterday is a kind of good sign. However, if the rhetoric gets stepped up, if increasingly Aer Lingus is withdrawing privileges from pilots, that is going to heat up the dispute and make a solution look really quite a long way away. And this is absolutely at a time when it is going to cause, and that's why the pilots have chosen it, maximum disruption to the to the airline, maximum disruption to pilots. And already the losses are running into many millions of euro, and they will continue, not least because, well, people aren't going to be booking Aer Lingus anytime soon if they think that there's going to be a massive there's a high chance of not travelling.
There's going to be a chill factor, isn't there? And you're detecting that already. Even down the line, people may be looking at flights later in the year. They're thinking, well, we don't know for sure if Aer Lingus, if that dispute's going to be solved. One last thing to talk to you about, Simon, and it is relevant. Normally after the news at 10 o'clock on a Friday, we talk to Linda McCauley. But you're probably aware she has just retired from On Your Behalf. You're a regular on that show as well. She's a regular on this show. Stephen sometimes wasn't able to get her to stop talking after 10 o'clock. You're going to miss her too.
Oh, look, Linda has done so much for the people of Northern Ireland, representing them, taking up individual cases and fighting so hard on their behalf. She has been an absolute marvel, a credit to Northern Ireland. She will be much missed, but I hope you're going to get her back because nobody knows as much as Linda.
And just on back to the story we were talking about, Aer Lingus, I mean, it's more a question for Linda than you in terms of consumer rights here. If you have been affected, just talk us through that if you can.
Oh, sure. Yeah, all very straightforward. And Linda would explain far more lucidly than me. If your flight is cancelled for any reason, then the airline has to get you to your destination as soon as possible, including buying a flight for you on Ryanair or on one of the transatlantic American Canadian airlines. If necessary, they've got to put you up in hotel accommodation if you're stranded, give you your meals. And then probably, I think there's a pretty good case for people getting cash compensation on top of that if they are seriously disrupted.
Cash. Just finally, Simon, before you go, are you going to be able to watch the Euros in France?
Yes, television has reached France. But no, I'm actually, I mean, and this is possibly of interest. I'm heading over to Germany, probably around about the 7th or 8th of July, because by then almost everybody will have left Germany. It's a wonderful country, and I think it will be a great opportunity to just enjoy some of the football in good company, whoever is taking part, which we sadly know won't be Scotland.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. You'll be in Germany for England in the final next month. Anna Curran, the stand-in presenter of On Your Behalf, will be with us after the 10 o'clock news. Well, normally at this stage on a Friday on the Nolan Show, Stephen interviews Linda McCauley about tomorrow's edition of On Your Behalf. All changed today. Stephen's having a break for a couple of weeks. Linda McCauley has gone. She has gone for good. Her stand-in this summer is with me on the studio, Anna Curran.
Morning, Mark. Good to see you.
Tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, a bit like yourself, really. I've got myself a bit of a summer job and I'll be stepping in to the On Your Behalf studio tomorrow morning from 10 o'clock. The lovely, fantastic Linda McCauley has, as you say, has decided to hang up the microphone and walk away. But there's no shortage of consumer stories that we need to pursue because the show must go on, and we are still going to advocate for everyone that's listening on very much on their behalf. And it's a busy old time. Tomorrow morning on the show, we're going to be picking up on what you've just been speaking to Simon Calder about there, and that is that pilot strike at Aer Lingus. Later today, a trade union committee is expected to decide whether to give the green light to a further stoppage by pilots. In case anyone missed Simon's summary there, 270 flights have so far been cancelled, and that's due to work to rule. And as it stands, Mark, an 8-hour strike is going to be in place from 5 o'clock tomorrow morning until 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and that could leave many people who have booked flights and summer holidays high and dry. So we are going to have the latest on those discussions. Plus, if you're sitting there and thinking, what am I going to do? My bags are packed, but I have nowhere to go. Well, I have somewhere to be, but I don't know how to get there. Then we will have all the answers, advice and information you need from the Consumer Council. Michelle Kelly will join me in studio. And if you're not planning to head away this summer, it's still a very expensive time, particularly if you have kids. They'll be off school, but you might have childcare costs.
Oh, yes.
Summer schemes. Yes. And if the weather's not that great, you might find yourself, like I will, at one of the many soft play centres.
You're a mum.
I am a mum. I'm a mum of two, so I'll be very busy. So any and all help is always welcome. And so we'll have our resident benefits expert, Rachel Jeffers, in studio just to give you a little bit of advice and information about what you might be entitled to. And Mark, I don't know if you're a fan of online shopping.
Oh, yes.
Well, I have a cautionary tale for you from one woman who loves the online shopping, but she ran afoul of the hidden cost of returning an item.
Yes.
And she was hit with a fee that was almost the price of the item that she wanted to return. So we've been, pardon the pun, we've been advocating on Elaine's behalf, and we got a bit of a good result. So I'll tell you all about that tomorrow. And a reformed scam artist tells me why he not only changed his ways, but now works to help others from being scammed. So all that tomorrow from 10 o'clock.
Anna, we wish you well. Big shoes to fill, but no better person. That's Anna Curran, standing in for the summer on your behalf. And we wish Linda McCauley all the very best. We miss her already. We're going to miss the election because this time next week, it'll all be over. We'll know all those results from North Down to North Belfast to North Antrim. But in the meantime, the debate goes on. We had the big leaders' debate. Well, at least three of the leaders were there last night at 9 o'clock on BBC One. You can watch it again on the iPlayer. You can also watch again an extended BBC Newsline, which was on just after the 10 o'clock news. The presenter, Catherine Morrison, she talked to the TUV leader, Jim Allister, to the Green Party's Brian Smith, and People Before Profits, Sean Harkin. Among the topics discussed was Jim Allister being asked about what his main electoral issues are, Brian Smith about the main parties failing to discuss the environment during that TV debate, and Sean Harkin was asked about the health service. Here's a flavour of what those three said.
The key issue is reunifying the United Kingdom, restoring our position in the UK, getting rid of the partitioning IRC border, reclaiming control over 300 areas of law which have been surrendered to a foreign parliament. And when that comes to the question of trust, you have the DUP, who in February were telling us they did a Donaldson deal which solved all those problems, got rid of the IRC border, blocked EU law, etc., etc. Then had to admit none of that was correct. So that does raise the fundamental question of trust, because then they were saying, they certainly wrote back, but now they're saying to the unionist community, though we tried to hoodwink you in February, vote for us in July? I don't think so.
But what for me was interesting tonight about that debate as well as the lack of any sort of environmental awareness, was it was the same tired old voices talking about funding and a lack of it, yet their only response is to go with a begging bowl to any future British government and ask for increased funding. As Greens, we believe that we need to look at taxation differently. And for us, we're in agreement with our sister parties in England, Scotland and Wales that there needs to be an introduction of a wealth tax on the richest 1%.
Well, we think there needs to be a redistribution of wealth away from the rich that the Tories have basically facilitated over the last 14 years towards public services. The NHS is a big priority. It needs to be properly funded. And that can be done. Wealth taxes. There is so much wealth in the UK. Unfortunately, a lot of it is in the hands of a tiny minority of people. You know, after this election, we need to see people power campaigns demanding that there's proper funding put towards the health service.
Just three of the parties. There are lots more. And if you want a full list of all the parties and all 136 candidates who are available for your votes next Thursday, there's a full list on the BBC News NI website. Of course, you can only vote if you're aged 18 or over. I'm slightly over, so I'm going to be allowed to vote. But what about your teenage children? Or maybe you're listening, you're 16, you're 17, you're politically active, you're really interested in politics, you even watched that debate last night, but you can't vote. Should something be done about that? Well, the BBC News' Ireland correspondent, Sarah Gervin, spoke to some A-level politics students in Newcastle at Shimna Integrated College in County Down. Sarah asked them how they felt about being unable to vote in this election because they're not 18 yet.
Politics is all around us, especially in Northern Ireland, and it's been a huge part of growing up. And I just think that the fact that we can't share our views on the future that will our future, it's just not fair, because the older people who are voting, like, they're voting for us, and it's just, it's ridiculous.
So my birthday is the 14th and then the election's on the 4th, so I'm off by 10 days to vote and be 18 to vote. So yeah, and I've registered and all, but yeah, so it's completely frustrating.
A lot of people just, they don't think the younger generation understands, but they probably have the best understanding of politics nowadays, especially with social media. They become more politically aware and they have less political allegiances. They're more likely to swing their vote. They're not bound by tradition or anything. They'll vote for who's best for them.
So you can drive a car next week if you're 17, but you can't vote in the general election. Is that fair? Let's ask the commentator Angela Epstein and the student Dermot Hamill. Angela, I'll go to you first. Good morning. What do you think?
Good morning, Mark. Well, you know, obviously I respect the views of these young people, and it's gratifying to know that if they feel engaged now, that with those couple of extra years, as they become more politically active, more understanding of the landscape, they will cast their vote in a very kind of informed way. But the fact is that 18 is the age where you're considered as to be an adult. And I think that's when voting rights should be given. I think, and I don't patronise here, my youngest just turned 20, and you know she obviously can vote now but couldn't in the last election. But I think it's clear, as a parent, I've seen lots of young people that I know who are smart and intelligent, but they don't know enough about the world or enough, have experience enough to really understand and engage with the sort of the complex issues that we need to be thinking about in the short term. Remember, an election, you know, there's a 5-year fixed term for the people that we elect. So things like social housing, things like taxation, you know, some of the very particular issues that people are going to be grappling with. And I think there's, I think that lack of understanding and engagement, and maybe that's a failing with schools or whatever, could see them, you know, voting for random candidates. Or it may even be that they just think, oh, this is all so complex, I'm not voting. And I was speaking to a pollster recently who does a lot of the big polls, that said that demographically speaking, if you don't vote the first time you're able to, you tend not to vote. So it would be a tremendous own goal if young people felt, you know, oh, this is just too complex, too much infighting. They don't vote, and then they get out of that spiral of voting. So I think it's worth waiting those extra couple of years. And you know, there are lots of things young people can't do at 16. You know, you can join the armed forces, but you still have to have parental permission. You can't serve on the front line till you're 18. You can't get married below the 18.
You can drive a car, though, Angela. That's a big responsibility.
Yeah, I agree with you that, but you can't use a tanning booth, buy cigarettes or fireworks or get a tattoo. So there's a suggestion of responsibility, and I actually would raise the age of being able to drive a car, actually. So I'm afraid that one doesn't. Sorry, Mark. I'd love to say yeah, great, but having watched four of my kids learn to drive, it wouldn't hurt to wait till 18.
It's not much fun, is it, Dermot?
And expensive.
Oh, lovely. Tell me about it. Yeah, expensive on your nerves as well. I'm yes. through it all. Thank goodness. Dermot, what would you say to Angela?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack there. I think, first of all, Angela mentioned all of the important things that, you know, you go through life doing at 18. This election, the big talk is tax. Of course, at 16, you can pay tax on any income. You can join the armed forces. And this election is going to be something that will seriously impact our young people, 16, 17. Whenever I was 16, 17, I ran a political podcast and interviewed some of the biggest names in British and Irish politics to suggest that back then I wasn't well enough engaged with young people or with the political world, with political understanding, with the issues. You know, it's fanciful. And
sorry, Dermot, but I mean, that is highly unusual to be so politically active at such a young age, is it not?
Yes, but I mean, even then, we have thousands of kids studying A-level politics right across the UK. We have kids are more engaged than they ever have been before, because it's simply on the basis that, you know, this affects us and it's so much more accessible. Everyone follows politics now because you can't afford not to.
Ooh, I'm not so sure about that, Angela. Do you think that our teenagers are more politically aware than ever before?
Yeah, but I think we need to separate two issues. Two of my kids did A-level politics, and there was no lack of suggestion that they didn't understand the political system, although actually the syllabus seemed to focus more on the American political system. So A-level politics isn't necessarily the immediate sort of get out of jail card for this argument. I think there's a big difference between understanding things theoretically. And when we vote, I mean, self-interest is king. When you're in the privacy of the ballot, of the polling booth, you think, actually, at 16, you probably haven't accrued vast amounts of wealth or even small amounts of wealth yet. So, but when you go into the ballot booth and you've already been out in the working world, even if it's only for a couple of years, you think, how much are they going to take out of my pocket? Am I going to be able to get a mortgage? What's going to influence interest rates coming down? And I think because naturally at 16, I would have think the common situation is to be living with parents, then those things may not impact on your choice. And the other thing I would say, mentioning parents, is that I personally think it's a bit of a cynical ploy to introduce this demographic into the electorate, because, you know, they're going to be maybe more influenced by what's going on at home. Social media is massive for younger people. They may go with the kind of big soundbite stuff, and maybe not drill down into the really diffuser, because they haven't got time and they haven't had enough time to engage. Which is why I think it would be so much better to just let it ruminate and marinate a bit longer.
Marinate. You're making me hungry as well. Yeah. What do you think, Dermot?
I mean, I think to suggest that young people are simply going to buy into the big talking points, I mean, as if older people don't do that as well. Like, of course, I'll be voting for a third time next week, and I'm very excited to do so, and I'll, you know, draw my little X in the box, and it'll be great. And whenever I was 9, I think I did it for my mother in the 24. No, I was 10 at the time and did it for my mother in one of the elections because I was really into it. But
I'm not sure that's allowed.
Well, I think if there were more people like Dermot, fantastic. I must say, I don't want to in any way be guilty of underplaying what you've done. I think it's phenomenal achievement to have a podcast and be so engaged. But I think you're sadly the exception rather than the rule. And that, I think, is the sort of the fulcrum of the argument here.
Well, the thing is, it was a podcast. Even taking the issue of the podcast, yes, I was a bit of a weirdo at 16.
No, you were engaged. You're engaged. Also, don't call yourself a weirdo.
A geek.
No.
We had thousands of people, young people, listening in from right across the UK. It was kids, you know, and it wasn't just, you know, political heads like me. It was like, it was my classmates. It was people from school. And then they were coming up to me and asking, oh, well, Dermot, what about corporate tax? Yeah. Like, to suggest that young people simply because they're 16 aren't politically engaged and aren't politically experienced enough. I mean, I didn't have a mortgage whenever I first went out to vote. And to be honest, I didn't think about my mortgage whenever I went into the assembly election. And I probably won't think about my chances of a mortgage whenever I go into it. However, whenever I voted in the assembly election, I was doing so as a university student. Or no, sorry, in the local council elections. But whenever I voted in the assembly election, I did so having just months before agreed at age 17 to take out thousands of pounds in loans for my university tuition and my living fees. I made massive decisions at 17. I was able to get taxed on any income I made. So surely, okay, because I can take such decisions like that, I should be able to vote.
Dermot and Angela, one last question, quick one for both of you. We know what you want to happen. Dermot, you go first. You know UK politics. Do you think the next government might actually change the voting limit?
I think they will, simply because it'll probably make it easier for Labour to get back in. But I'd say they will.
Oh, Dermot. Dermot's gone. Oh. Angela, what do you think is going to happen?
I'm afraid that one point on which Dermot and I respectfully do agree is that I think this is a huge, I'm sorry to say that, sorry, it doesn't make us good radio, but I think this is a massively cynical ploy, because already Labour, unfortunately, seem to be sort of foregone conclusion it's going to be an electoral wipeout for the Tories. And this will just, and they will then cement their position if 16-year-olds can vote. They make all the right noises, all those kind of Glastonbury-like sound bites that 16-year-olds who aren't engaged like Dermot like. You got it. They'll be there for decades, unfortunately.
Angela, Dermot, thank you both very much indeed. You mentioned Glastonbury. It's a big weekend for music in Glastonbury and also in Dublin. The one and only Taylor Swift, sold out concert, sadly, at the Aviva in Dublin tonight, tomorrow night and Sunday night. 150,000 people, not just from the island of Ireland, but if you can get there, in spite of the Aer Lingus problems, from all over Europe are going to be descending on Dublin to pay for the privilege of hearing Taylor Swift. If you're into music and you want to hear it for free, go down to any city centre, and you'll hear buskers. It's up to you whether you want to throw them a few quid or not. But how do we keep and encourage that next generation of grassroots music artists here in Northern Ireland? Is busking the key? Is that how we discover the next Taylor Swift? Or is it the last thing you want to hear when you're around Belfast or Derry or Newry? Oh no, another busker. Boyd Slater is from Free the Night NI. He wants to liven up the city centre. Would more buskers help? The former Lib Dem MP, Lembit Opic, his name is an anagram of I like to be MP. Lembit, that is true, isn't it?
It is true, yeah. What are the odds?
What are the odds, yeah. Yeah, that ship has sailed. Do you like buskers and do you think we could discover the next Taylor?
I love buskers. I hate it when they can't busk. And I think there has to be a rule about it. We live in a society, in a woke society, where everything has to be protected, and protected from air pollution. Well, this is noise pollution. There used to be this busker in Westminster when I did like to be an MP, and she used to try and play the violin. I could have played it better. It was like nails going down a blackboard. It was horrendous. And she actually bothered me standing there, talentless. And so I think there has to be some standard, maybe a basic qualification at least. Because otherwise, if I just stood next to your house and started shouting, you'd have something to say about it. Well, this is the same.
Well, that's what we want to talk about. Is it time to improve buskers by having some sort of licensing system, maybe even auditions? Boyd Slater, what do you think?
I think it's kind of funny. I think maybe there needs to be a qualification for some of our MPs, never mind our buskers. But
I agree with you on that too.
It's called an election, Boyd.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure about the qualification. But what I would say is, you talked about Taylor Swift there. an amazing artist, pop artist, with an awful lot of money to be able to put a lot into production value. And that's really what's needed for buskers. We need infrastructure for them. We need to put on a pedestal those that are amazing and really, really good, brighten up the city. But it's all about infrastructure for them and support for them. And really, the fact of the matter is that, art's subjective. And if the MP there on the show there with us, sorry, I've just forgotten your
Lambert,
name.
Lambert Opec. Lambert,
if he doesn't like the music, he's welcome to walk on. That's what he can do. He can move on. So that's the way it is.
But it's not that way. I agree with the idea of infrastructure, but putting a terrible musician in a nice place, that's like putting lipstick on a pig. It doesn't change the appalling output. And there used to be a bagpipes player, might still be there, on Westminster Bridge. That was the one reason I wanted Scottish independence, so he could clear off back to his own land, because it really, really annoyed me. And the fact is, he could play it, but he always played the same old rubbish every time, and I used to have to walk across it. So I do think there has to be some way to stop this. And I'm a libertarian, but it's just too much when they can't play.
Let's get serious.
It's not often that I get this annoyed about something, but I would tell you what needs to be is basic qualification. For example, you say you have to have some basic musical competence. Now, that's a good thing as well, because it achieves what my friend here would like to do, which is reignite music. And in the 80s, when I lived in Northern Ireland, I was involved with the Musicians' Union to keep music live, and I did that when I was an MP. So I agree with what you want to do. But have a qualification. Otherwise, any idiot can stand on any street corner and annoy people like me.
But have a qualification. What is that qualification? Who is that
arbiter? My seven-year-old.
What we actually need is infrastructure to be able to manage the city centre with buskers and with musicians. And we need to be able to give people a platform to be able to perform and support them to be able to perform. I don't really know what you're asking for, other than you don't like some of this music, you have to walk past it, it bothers you. So what? Keep walking.
Okay. I do, but the fact is that you tend to get the same people in the same places making the same annoying sound. The answer to your question is simple. I agree with the infrastructure point, and to some extent they've done that a little bit in London as places for buskers. And some of them are brilliant. Some of them just brighten your day. But then you should have the quid pro quo here. You should have some basic level of competence. And my daughter's learning piano, and she's got grade one or grade two or something, and that's not bad for a seven-year-old, but it means she actually knows what she's doing, and I don't mind that. Then my three-year-old gets on, bangs away on the thing, and it's terrible.
Just a second. Having a grade in music does not make you a performer. We know some of our best performers never went to music school. Some of them don't even read music, and we have amazing performers that are like that. I mean, this is again back to subjectivity. Look, you don't have a qualification for being an MP. I mean, I think that there's actually probably more to say that you should have one. An MP should have some sort of basic qualification.
I'm consistent. I agree.
Hold your horses. We've got a quick caller. Michael, what point would you like to make? Quickly, if you can.
Hello, Mark Super Sub. Just to let you know, there's a great Belfast City Blues Festival from today all over the weekend, and lots of the venues are free all over. Kelly's, Dirty Onion, White's, Common Market, everywhere. The Belfast Barge, everywhere.
Thank you, Michael.
And he's a professional blues artist, yep.
Do you like buskers, Michael?
Some of them I do. Some I can do without. Can I give a name check? One of the best out there, Joe McGee. I call him Banjo. He's excellent.
Banjo. I see what you did there. I like that, Banjo. Michael.
Yeah.
I like that.
You've inspired me. I'll bring my harmonica then. And I'll stand in the corner, see how much I can make. I'm not qualified to play this, but maybe you've inspired me to join the cacophony of unqualified musicians after all.
Play a little bit more. It's going to be the day Mark Simpson killed the Nolan show. Play a little bit more, Lambert.
There you are. You have that one for free.
Lambert, that was Radio Gold. Thank you very much. Thank you also to Boyd Slater. What a pity the programme is nearly over. Thanks for all your calls, particularly on our leaders debate. But we covered a health story as well, a very important health story about an 83-year-old man in Cumber who had to wait for an ambulance. We have a statement from the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. I want to read it out. They'd like to apologise to the patient and his family. They say that we are truly sorry for the wait and the pain endured as a result of the day in responding to the call. We believe it is unacceptable that patients should have any delay in ambulances responding to their needs. Calls received in our emergency ambulance control are prioritised on receipt. Those which are most clinically urgent will receive our immediate and available resource. Thank you to the ambulance service. Sorry we said 8 hours. The wait was just under 2 hours. Thank you for your company today. A big weekend of sport, a big weekend of music. Whatever you're doing, enjoy yourselves. I'll see you Monday.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show.
Beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig. Schon probiert? Den legendären Big Mac gibt's jetzt in 2 weiteren Varianten. Den Double Big Mac für den doppelten Genuss und den Big Mac Bacon TS mit knusprigem Bacon. Nur für kurze Zeit und nur bei McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. In allen teilnehmenden Restaurants, nur solange der Vorrat reicht.
Sommer, Sonne, sowas von besonders. Jetzt die coolen Mercedes-Benz Sommerhits entdecken. Über 4000 attraktive Vorführ- und Geschäftswagen aus unserem Bestand. Von A-Klasse bis V-Klasse, von Cabriolet bis SUV. Alle kurzfristig verfügbar, alle zu Top-Konditionen, alle für Sie bereit. Sommer, Sonne, Sommerhits. Nur bei Ihrer Mercedes-Benz-Niederlassung vor Ort.